You remember at the end of last time, we more or less completed our discussion of the action of the rotation group in three dimensions on some position space wave functions. So we found from the algebra, simply from the commutation relations, that the eigenvalue, the parameter L that characterizes the eigenvalue of L squared, has to be a half non-negative integer. And a further constraint from the fact that if you take a position wave space wave function psi of x, you rotate all the way around through 2 pi, the coordinate x rotates back to itself, psi is single valued, and so we need that rotation to give us the identity. That tells us that the parameter m has to be an integer, and since the difference between m and l is also an integer, that also tells us that L has to be an integer. And we ended up with this set of constraints in the box here. L, some non-negative integer, and M lying in the range minus L to L. So that characterizes the so-called orbital angular momentum. If we're thinking of a particle moving in a central potential, we're interested in the angular momentum of its position wave space wave function. We can break up the wave function into a superposition of states of different L and M, and we have a complete list of the possible values of L and M there. But nature doesn't let the more general possibility that we excluded here, the possibility of half integers, go to waste. As well as position space wave function, we can and we should think of particles as carrying some internal properties. You could think of it as an internal structure, but maybe that's not quite the right image. Some internal degree of freedom, extra physical quantities that are associated with the particle, and to the extent that the particle is point-like, are sitting there at that point. So the metaphor, the standard metaphor for this, which obviously is you're going to break if we press it too far, because it's a classical metaphor for a quantum phenomenon, is it's as though this little particle, although point-like, is capable of having something like spin about some. All is well. Something like spin about some axis in space. And if we just play with the metaphor for a moment, if you rotate through an angle, of course you're going to change the position of the particle, but you're also going to change the orientation of the axis about which it's spinning. So to the extent that metaphor is useful at all, I guess it's in persuading us that it's a reasonable and natural possibility that internal degrees of freedom can be acted on by the rotation group. And we can separate out the action on the two Hilbert spaces. The full Hilbert space is going to be a tensor product of the internal Hilbert space and the Hilbert space corresponding to the position degrees of freedom. And go through the arguments we've just gone through already to look at the action of rotations on internal states. So here's a rotation about the x-axis, in this case through an angle alpha. That's going to be given by e to the I, some operator that we need, let's call it Sx, that generates the rotation times alpha over h bar. And similarly, rotations about y and about z are going to be associated with operators Sy, Sz. Well, we've already analyzed the commutation relations of the generators of the rotation group, and a little bit of thought, you might want to You might want to fill in the gap in the argument here for yourself. But a little bit of thought persuades us that given the structure of the rotation group, these generators have to have the same commutation relations as those that we already know for Li, that we worked out explicitly from Li because we had an explicit description. So the point here is these things are generating the same group, and so we're going to end up with the same commutation relations. So we have Si, Sj is I epsilon, Ijk, Sk up to h bar. And S squared, the sum of the Si squareds, commutes with each of them, just as L squared commuted with the Li's. So we've already run through the analysis for this. We know that the eigenvalue of S squared is going to be parameterized. It's going to be SS plus 1, where the parameter S is going to have to be half of a non-negative integer, so 0, half, 1, 3 halves, and so on. And the eigenvalue of S3 is going to lie in the range minus S to S, and it's going to differ from S, therefore, by an integer. And now we don't have an argument that says that we have an explicit action on position coordinates, and therefore we have to get precisely the identity when we rotate through 2 pi. We're acting now on quantum states, lying in the spin Hilbert space. And the crucial thing is that if we rotate through 2 pi, we get back the same quantum state. But the possibility that we pick up some phase is not excluded by that argument. In particular, if it's the case that the rotation through 2 pi takes our quantum state psi and gives us the state minus psi, well, that's still the same physical state. We're interested in the ended rays in Hilbert space rather than the factors in front of them. So that's perfectly, there's no inconsistency in that possibility. Because we actually... We're actually acting directly on wave functions that depend on the coordinates, x1, x2, x3. And the wave function is a single-valued thing. Psi of x is a complex number. Rotate through 2 pi, you got back to psi of the same point, x, and so you must have the same complex number again. Okay, so, and why did I pick out a minus sign here rather than a more general phase? Because our analysis has already told us that the only possible values of m are half integers. How to phrase that? I mean, half integer includes integer, if you see what I mean. Take half of an even integer, you get an integer. So m differs from s by an integer. If m is itself actually an integer, well, then we get a plus sign. If m is a half integer, we get a minus sign. We wouldn't necessarily be worried if we got more general phases, but the algebra doesn't allow it, so we don't need to worry about it. So all of these solutions are allowed in the case of spin. And indeed, it's not just that they're mathematically allowed, but nature very much makes use of them. It turns out, and this, I can give you the statement, but the proof is beyond our scope here. But it turns out that there's a correlation between the statistics of of any given particle, whether it's a boson or a fermion, and the value of S being either integer, which is true in the case of bosons, or integer plus a half in the case of fermions. So, for instance, photons, gravitons, let's have spin 1, spin 2, the Higgs, that even when if and when and whether it's found. The W, the Z also fall into our list of bosons. The electrons, quarks, neutrinos, other fermions have integer plus a half value squared. So if we're looking at a single particle, for instance, with non-trivial internal spin degrees of freedom, and we're looking also at its wave function position space, the full Hilbert space we need to analyze is given by the tensor product of these two things. We have the spin operator, which acts on that first factor, the orbital angular momentum, which acts on the second factor. And if we really want to understand the full action of the rotation group, we need to look at what happens when, what happens when we apply a rotation, and both of those things happen. So we need to look at the total angular momentum, conventionally called J, which is given by the sum of those two things. This isn't hard to develop, given the algebra we've already got. It's often covered in undergraduate quantum theory courses, and just really because we're not going to need it in the near future, I'm going to put it aside and maybe suggest an exercise or two for review for people who are less familiar or a little bit rusty on it. So I want to turn now to a particularly nice way of visualizing the action of rotation groups for spin half particles. And so now our discussion is going to forget about the position space component. Just focus on the two-dimensional Hilbert space corresponding to spin half. Two dimensions because we have m equals a half, one state like that, another state, m equals minus a half. They're linearly independent, but they're the only values of m, and they together span the Hilbert space. Okay. Well, our convention was that m corresponds to the z-axis, and the z-axis tends to point that way. So we're thinking of these things as though one of them is saying you've got a spin with some particular convention, with some particular orientation going around the z-axis like this. The other one's going like that, and you might as well, another way of thinking about that is that it's this rotating the same way, but about the negative z-axis. So conventionally, we write these states as up, let's say clockwise rotation about the positive z-axis, down clockwise rotation about the negative z-axis. So I can write a general state in this space, if I'm not worrying about normalization, as some linear combination. AE up plus B down, A and B are just general complex numbers. And there's obviously a good deal of redundancy in that. So one way to deal with the redundancy is just divide through by b to the minus 1. So my new convention is I have down times just 1 plus a b to the minus 1 up. There's a little bit of a glitch with that convention. Namely, of course, that up itself is a perfectly valid state in Hilbert space, and it has no component at all of down. So if I'm going to write things this way, and I'm happy to, for the moment, to forget about normalization, I'd also better include the possibility that, so to speak, this coefficient here is infinite. If I had infinity times up plus 1 times down, well, if I were to rescale that, divide through by infinity, that would give me up plus 1 over infinity times down. In other words, it would give me up plus 0 down, or just up. The better way of thinking about that is that we're really working not with complex numbers, but with numbers that live in the complex projective plane. So take the complex plane, but include the point at infinity. And it doesn't really matter which way you go, you get to the point at infinity. So our spin states for the spin half particle, this two-dimensional Hilbert space correspond via this coefficient to points in the complex projective plane, complex numbers together with infinity. And then there's a very nice way of representing the complex projective plane, which is probably familiar from complex analysis courses. But anyway, here it is. Here's a number z. Let's take a sphere and let it sit so that it's just tangential to the point zero on the plane. Sitting like that, it has, if memory serves, it has radius one. And our idea is this. If we've got any point on the plane and we want to map it to the sphere, we're going to take that point, join it to the North Pole, the point at the top of the sphere, by a straight line. That's about as straight a line as my handwriting seems to allow. And then look at the point where that line intersects the sphere. So our map is going to be from this point here to this point, the intersection point on the sphere. And you'll notice the point zero, well, it's already touching the sphere, so it gets mapped to the south pole, so to speak, that point there. And the point at infinity, well, it's, if you think as you get further and further away from zero, this map is going to take you to points that get closer and closer to the north pole. And again, it doesn't really matter which direction, that statement is true, no matter which direction you go away from zero. Go out this way, I'll be mapping to points that are somewhere around here, close to the North Pole. Go out that way, well, I'm mapping to points that are somewhere around here, but they're still close to the North Pole. And so the natural way to think about completing this map is to take the point at infinity and map it onto the North Pole. And that's what we're going to do. What have we done? What we've done is create a very simple geometric representation of all the possible states of a spin half particle, all the possible internal states of a spin half particle. And it's not just a pretty picture, it's something that actually gives us a very nice way of understanding the actions of the rotation group on those states, among other things. So, what do we notice if we play about with that for a little bit? We find that these eigenvalues of SZ, the down and the up, map respectively to the south pole and north pole. And of course, they're orthogonal. So we have one orthogonal basis corresponding to SZ given by these two states. If we look at the action of SX and SY, well, we can write those down. And again, we have factors of half h bar. But up to those factors, they're given by what are probably familiar objects, in any case, are rather simple objects. These matrices here, the Pauli matrices. So sigma x, also written as sigma 1, also sometimes written as capital X, is just this one, 0, 1, 1, 0. There's sigma y, there's sigma z. And these are acting on our conventional basis, the up-down basis, the basis of z eigenstates. So indeed, we can see that these things are eigenstates of sigma z. These matrices satisfy a very simple product rule and so a very simple commutation relation. And we see that we already see a hint here that these two states are aligned along the z-axis and are indeed the eigenstates of sigma z. It won't come as a great surprise to say that if you complete the calculation and look at the eigenstates of sigma x, they're indeed aligned along the x-axis. Sorry, my x-axis is coming out this way. So these two states are the eigenstates of sigma x, and the eigenstates of sigma y, likewise, are the antipodes along the y-axis. And if we want to understand the action of the rotation group for a general rotation, for instance, about the z-axis, for a general state in this space, it's given very prettily and intuitively in terms of the geometry of this sphere. If I want to rotate through an angle alpha about the z-axis, well, I need e to, this is the operator I need, and what's it, what does it do? It rotates the sphere through that angle about the z-axis. And similarly, if I want to rotate about the x-axis, I need to rotate the sphere around x, and so on. Remember, we're going to pick up a factor of minus one when we do these rotations, but we're not going to change the actual state. If I rotate about the z-axis through 2 pi, this state will become minus itself. But if I renormalize, if I go back to the conventions, it's still the same state. So we're seeing another very nice interplay between physics, of spin in this case, algebra, these operators SZ and their commutation relations and the analysis that gives us the possible values of L and M, and geometry, this very intuitively appealing and easy to understand representation of the states in terms of the sphere. Oh, I should say, by the way, and you might want to check this, going back to our definitions of how, starting with the complex plane and then projecting onto the sphere. It's not just true of sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z that we obtain orthogonal states, orthogonal antipodal states corresponding to the eigenstates of those operators. But quite generally, if I take any pair of antipodal states on the Bloch sphere, they correspond to a pair of orthogonal states, and they're the eigenstates for the operator that rotates around the relevant axis. So we've got a way of thinking about all the possible orthonormal bases for this two-dimensional space, and indeed thinking about the rotation operator for which those bases are the eigenstates, and the actions of that operator on the rest of the states. Oh, tragedy. There's some little glitch in producing some of these diagrams so that they look absolutely perfect when I go through them before the lecture, and suddenly they dissolve. It doesn't really matter. I just wanted to give a couple of other conventional ways of representing the states on the Bloch sphere. Let me just see if the next one works. Oh, something very odd. Okay.
Maybe if you zoom out.
Sorry?
Maybe if you zoom out.
Zoom out. Now, there's a sophisticated thought. zoom.
Or maybe take full screen.
Yeah, yeah. Full
screen. Okay. You see, you people are children of the computer era. Thank you. So let's go back. Thank you very much for that. Okay. This is just the same picture with different labels. When people talk about quantum computing, they're not really so interested in spin necessarily. They're just interested in building things up from two-dimensional Hilbert spaces. And one tends to use a language that's more natural in the context of computing, which you just take your canonical orthogonal basis to be given by the states 0 and 1, and then we have other linear combinations of those states. So this is 0 plus 1 up to normalization, this is 0 minus 1, this is 0 minus I1, and this is 0 plus I1. And this this is all that people mean when they talk about a qubit, a single qubit. It's a quantum analog of quantum extension of the idea of a bit. So a classical computer would, elementary register of a classical computer would have to be either in the state 0 or 1. The quantum analog can be in the state 0, can be in the state 1, but of course it could be in any superposition, anything, any of these states interpolating in any of these directions between 0 and 1. The spin basis, that really is the picture we've already explored. So these are the eigenstates of sigma z, or sz, sigma y, sigma x. And here's a more general.
It goes from 0 to 4 pi in this case.
Sorry, what goes from 0 to 4 pi?
Theta. I mean, if you define it.
Why? What?
And if theta was, say, 2 pi.
Right.
You should get back to the same point, right? If you start from theta equals 0 to theta equals 2 pi.
No, that's the whole point. You have to go 4 pi.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah, like you make
But you could define theta to go from 0 to 4 pi.
Well, no, theta is you're parameterizing three dimensional space, right? It can only go.
Yeah, sorry, this is just parameterizing the states on the sphere itself here. So we want theta to run from 0 to pi, I guess, in order to go from the top to the bottom.
But isn't it usually the azimuthal angle that's in the, I think the diagram just has theta and pi.
So. Mixed up?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's
good.
Yeah, it's
good.
Well, it may be that my conventions are
check some simple
woozy, but I think the diagram is consistent.
Question: what is this formal cosine tau zero theta and tau cosine in both places?
Sorry.
Why? Because you want to do 4 pi bracket to get back to the same thing. Because this is spin half. Yeah, so I mean, that's what I said. With this picture, you have theta going to zero.
So if we start at theta equals zero, we'll be here. As theta increases, we get, for a general phi, we get the circle around here. As theta gets towards pi over 2, we get to equally weighted superpositions, so that would correspond to the equator here, I believe. No?
It would be so if you could add tau.
Sorry, wait a minute. 3 equals pi over 2 cos. No, I think that's right. Cos of pi over 4 equals sine pi over 4 in modulus. So we get equally weighted superpositions for pi over 2. And as for theta equals pi, this term is 0, this term is 1, and we're down here. A lot of discussion, but, well, is anybody unhappy at this point? If you get back to me if you find an inconsistency or a problem, we can sort it out. It's also useful to know that polarizations of photons actually follow the same calculus. You can have vertically polarized light and horizontally polarized light, and those are orthogonal possibilities, and conventionally they're represented by those two states. Diagonally polarized light, which is intermediate between those two, and can go that way or that way, conventionally those two. And also, although it's a little trickier to create, circularly polarized light, which is an equally weighted superposition, but with an extra phase of plus I or minus I. I can't remember actually which way around they go. Conventionally, those two. So we often once we've established the fact that we're working with a 2D Hilbert space, we often just flip back and forwards between these conventions, or don't even particularly fix any definite convention in the discussion. People who are talking about photon interferometry experiments might well use the computational basis to describe the states they're working with, especially if they're thinking about some sort of information-related task or something to do with quantum computing. Okay. So if I've got a state on the Bloch sphere, and I don't want that state, I want some other state, if I have the power to do it, one way to achieve the state I actually want is to take a Hamiltonian that will rotate it. So some Hamiltonian that has this form, apply it for time t, and that will produce a rotation about the axis corresponding to the unit vector n. So for instance, if my state starts out here and I actually want it over here, if I apply a Hamiltonian that produces rotations about the z-axis and wait for the right time, I end up with a state there. But there's another interesting way of manipulating states on the Bloch sphere. Add this footnote at this point. There's another interesting way of manipulating states on the Bloch sphere, which in fact works much more generally, but it's particularly easy to visualize on the Bloch sphere, just as what I just said works much more generally. If you've got a state in the wrong place in Hilbert space and you want to move it, if you can find the right Hamiltonian, you can evolve it to the state you actually want. But it's particularly easy to see what's happening on the Bloch sphere. Likewise, what I'm about to describe, the quantum Zeno effect, is quite a general phenomenon, and you might like to work out for yourselves how it works in larger dimensions and be sure that you're happy that it does work in dimensions greater than two. But let's describe it in the 2D case. I'm going to describe two possibilities. Actually, there's a more general possibility that, again, I think we'll ask you to explore in an example. The first thing is a slightly different situation from the one I just described. We've got a state, and we're actually happy with it. We want to keep it in that state. But there's an external Hamiltonian that we can't get rid of that's trying to move it away. So our state is, for instance, zero, and the Hamiltonian is causing it to drift along this curve. So at time t, maybe it's got to there. Well, if we could kill the Hamiltonian or apply one that cancels it, maybe we would. But there's another interesting possibility. Instead of worrying about the unitary evolution law, we could think what the projection postulate, what the measurement postulate in quantum theory might do for us. So let's try a different game. Suppose our state indeed starts out in zero, it starts evolving, but after a short time, we carry out a measurement of the observable whose eigenprojections are the zero state and its orthogonal partner, the one state. So we carry out a measurement defined by these two projectors, projector onto zero and projection onto one. We start out in zero, we've drifted a little way. What's the probability that after the measurement we get the outcome corresponding to zero, and so the state is back at state zero? Well, it's given by the inner product of the projection with the evolved state, which just gives us this thing, zero with the small evolution acting on zero mod squared of that. And we've expanded this out in powers of delta t. I'll get 1 minus I delta t over h bar, and then I have the expectation of just h with zeros around it. And the delta t squared term will give me delta t squared over h bar squared. And now I'm expanding out this exponent term by term. So the second term is delta t squared, and the corresponding operator is h squared. So I get the expectation value of h squared. And I really should have written approximately equals here. I'm going to stop there because I'm not going to worry about terms higher than delta t squared for the moment. So what do we have here? Well, this is still a modulus squared thing. So we're going to, and it's modulus squared of a real quantity, which is given by this term and this term, and an imaginary quantity given by this. So to order delta t squared, they both contribute. And I can collect them together in this expression, the variance in h. So the variance h squared is zero, the expectation of h squared minus the expectation of h squared. And to order delta t squared, that's all we get, those two contributions. We get a factor of whatever h bar squared, and then higher order terms. Okay, well, that's certainly not very hard to check. What does it buy us? The key thing here is that this is ordered delta t squared rather than ordered delta t. So suppose my situation, if I wasn't doing anything, is the following. The state starts out in the one I want at time 0, but it's going to be left for time t, capital T, which may be quite long. And during that time, left to its own devices, it will drift far away from 0 on the Bloch sphere, some state over here, maybe. What I'm going to do is divide that time interval up into a large number of small intervals, so delta t is t over n, and iterate this process n times. After each of those intervals, I'm going to carry out the same measurement, asking whether it's in state 0 or state 1, so to speak.
Adrian, yeah. Can I have one question? Why do you need the Bloch sphere for imagining this effect?
As I've been trying to stress, you don't need this Bloch sphere. It's just you can draw slightly prettier pictures on the Bloch sphere, that's all. I'm going to show you a pretty picture.
Okay, but like the evolution over time, it makes
it. The algebra.
Slices.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. A wise person once told me that mathematicians divide into people who think algebraically and people who think geometrically. If you think geometrically, you might be happier thinking about this on the Bloch sphere. If you think algebraically, it's just sort of irrelevant noise, probably. Okay. So we're going to do this total of n times. And the question is, what's the probability that we get the right answer? In other words, we keep the state as the one we want, not just once or a few times, but throughout that process, all n times. Well, there's some constant in here, but the key thing was that it's order delta t squared, so it's order n to the minus 2. So the probability of getting it right once is this thing in the brackets. The probability of getting it right all n times is this thing in the brackets to the power n. And the crucial thing is that we've got order n to the minus 2 there and power n there. So this total probability of getting it right each time is still order n to the minus 1. It's still something that tends to 1 as n tends to infinity. So however big the Hamiltonian is, however large its eigenvalues are, in other words, however long the time interval is, if we have the power to examine the state frequently enough throughout that time interval, we're effectively going to, we're freezing it in the state 0. I guess the precise statement is each time we carry out the measurement, we will find it in the state 0 after the measurement. And so at the end of that whole process, it will still be the case, we find it in the state 0. So, yes, please.
Why the Hamiltonian has an arbitrary norm? It's often unbounded.
I'm assuming here it's bounded. We're just talking about a Hamiltonian for a 2D system here. We're not worrying about the position degrees of freedom. So I think it's actually quite a reasonable assumption that we can diagonalize it. And it just has two eigenvalues, and they're both They're both finite, otherwise it's not a word of an operator at all.
Okay.
Yeah. But thank you, it's good. And in fact, that ties into something I'm about to, ties in a little bit at least to something I'm about to mention. People sometimes summarize this as, there's the classical proverb, a watch pot never boils, but actually experimental evidence suggests that's false. But in this precise sense, in other words, if you take the statement as summarizing the calculation we've just done, there we can say that a quantum watch pot almost certainly really does not boil. The worry is that you sort of take that last thing as a rigorous statement of what's really going on and start to over-extrapolate it.
So why doesn't it work?
Why doesn't the classical pot,
yeah,
watch pot? Okay. I'm going to answer that question with a question. So quite a while ago, when I was a postdoc, I was actually at the IAS in Princeton, and the director came to lunch and said that somebody who'd given the institute quite a lot of money wanted advice. So somebody had come to them and said, "Look, I've got a wonderful scheme that will solve all the world's, or many of the world's, energy problems or the problems of radioactive waste. Here's my idea. We've got new radioactive atoms. We want to use them for nuclear power. But in the meantime, annoyingly, they're decaying. There's a certain half-life. We don't want that because it degrades them. It makes them less useful. So we're going to stop them from decaying. How are we going to do that? We're going to use the quantum Zeno effect." So his idea was something like this. Here's your nuclear fuel. And he wanted to surround it with Geiger counters, all the way around, Geiger counters. Very, very good Geiger counters, I guess. And his idea was, at every instant, these things are checking whether or not the fuel has decayed, has emitted alpha particles or whatever the relevant things are. And so if we really surround it, and obviously in three dimensions, we could freeze it. We could ensure that it won't decay at all. It will just sit there. So my question to you is, would you invest in such a scheme? And if so, why? And if not, why not?
I mean, you would spend loads of energy just. It probably needs more energy making sure that it stays in place than you would get from the fuel.
It will not work, obviously.
And not for Geiger counters, but if you had some light source that would shine light at the atoms, and it would shine light at lower frequency than the excitation levels, then you could, in practice, all the time measure it.
Wait.
So a better version of this is not having Geiger counters, but light source.
Tell me, what exactly is the light source doing?
I think the measurement process, I mean, if you hit an atom with a photon, mm-hmm, that itself should be a measurement.
Maybe, okay. So, and
that's an assumption that this is a measurement.
And the idea is that we can tell the difference between a decayed atom and an undecayed atom,
yeah,
by something about the light that's scattered from it, one way or another.
And if the frequency of the light was small enough, so that's not excite the atom, and that's not to produce fission spontaneously.
Okay, which seems reasonable.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you could, in practice, have something like this, but then I think still the energy could be. Financially, it might not be feasible, but physically.
Okay. Well, I mean, whether something's going to be financially feasible or not is a sort of second order question. I mean, the first question. There was a statement over there that, at least going back to the original scheme, it just obviously can't work. You said that, right? So why? Why do you think that?
We're not sure about it.
Hmm?
Should work.
An atom could be a mixed state of a decade and one decade, I guess, each time. And we, and when we count it, well, we are sure it's in the decade. It's a decade atom, not a, an undecayed atom. Well, but by the time it's a mixed state, not, none of them, I guess. It should be. If we measure, then it's a, it's we know what's it. It's no different.
Let's see if I understand that. The idea is that if we look at any individual atom, it's there's at least a small, it's actually in a superposition, maybe with one component much larger than another, of decayed and undecayed all at any given point in time. That might be true, okay. It's also true, of course, that our state on the top of the boxosphere, after a tiny time, evolves a little way from that. So it's also in a little superposition of 0 and 1. So I'm not saying you're wrong, but you might have to flesh out the argument a little bit more to say why what works on the blocksphere isn't going to work because of, in this case. Yeah. Is there more?
Well, I have to think about it.
Okay. Yeah?
I mean, if the Geiger counter goes off, it did decay. So if you, once you, to perform a measurement, you're ensuring that radiation escapes in some sense.
That kind of depends, I mean, but if the Geiger counter didn't go off,
right.
it didn't decay.
Right.
So for better or for worse, the idea here was that if you surround it by Geiger counters, none of them are ever going to go off. Because of some sort of Zeno-esque intuition.
I mean, the point is that if you measure it only a very short time after you prepared it, then almost certainly it did not decay. So in this sense, the Geiger counters ensure in the long run that it doesn't decay, if it worked.
If it's big. Yeah. Any more thoughts at the moment on this? And can we at least have more thoughts? Yeah, please.
You said that's for a two-level system. But
yeah.
This is a big system.
Yeah, but that works also for bigger systems.
But maybe this is a valid worry because we're. This is perhaps an infinite dimensional system, and we ought to at least think carefully about the analysis. So yes, that's something to worry about. Yep.
I mean, like the Hamiltonian for nuclear decay is probably. The energy change is probably pretty big, so the characteristic time that you would have to measure it would probably be small.
Okay.
And I think the time to travel to the edge of this chamber is probably, it's probably too large of a time. I guess the idea is that you have to measure something so frequently that it can't really move from the North Pole.
Uh-huh.
But if it's able to travel and then you measure it, that doesn't really help you.
You've got to be able to tune your measurements to be very, very frequent. Yes, on a scale that's determined by the Hamiltonian. So, can we say anything about Geiger counters in that context? Is it clear that it will work or won't work?
You can say that the Geiger counter itself has some average time, so it doesn't perform the continuous measurement. It does perform just one measurement per some time.
Yes.
So we can do more measurements.
I could always build a better Geiger counter that works faster.
Yeah. Yes, and you can hold the atom a little bit longer. You can be sure a little bit longer, but atomic times is 10 to minus 20 third or something like that.
Yeah. So there's a real worry here that the model of measurement we've been applying, which is really an instantaneous measurement to protect, we apply the projector 0 or 1 at some particular time, actually is missing something crucial about the physics here. Like a Geiger counter takes some finite time to produce a result. It doesn't give an instantaneous answer yes or no. That seems like a good worry, and we might have to. If we take that seriously, we might actually have to model in some detail the measurement process in the Geiger counter and see what it tells us. about this situation.
I guess.
We'll take one here.
One thing that if you make sure that the atom has decay, you are not collapsing the wave function because it has already decayed. So you are not the measure is not being a quantum measure but a classical somehow because you are predicting the effects of what the nuclear fuel did.
Yes. Yeah, I like that thought. Am I expressing this? Well, we're not actually really asking, we're not actually looking at the atom itself and asking, has an alpha particle just this instant emerged, or is it just emerging from it? We're asking, is there an alpha particle somewhere over here? And that's, that again seems to deviate from our discussion of the Bloch sphere, where at least intuitively we've got a system right under our control we're looking at. Any more quick comments on this? There was one over there.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, I guess the Geiger counter can't ensure us that the atom has decayed, the state of atom is decayed or undecayed or something mixed between. It can only ensure us that the atom is decayed. Well, but it can't tell us if it's somewhere between or just at the North Pole. It can't tell us.
It's a binary measurement, right? Yeah, at least in the way it's presented. You either get a click or you don't. But that's true of our measurement on the Bloch sphere as well. It's also you either get zero or one.
Well, I guess if the state is somewhere in between, in the middle, the Geiger says nothing about it.
Do you? Let me leave that question.
It hasn't.
You could say the same thing that the Geiger counter actually never might tell it.
One more comment over here.
So a problem is that you would have to be measuring the Geiger counter repeatedly for the Geiger counter to be actually measuring a definite state for the system inside. You'd have to measure the outer system. Otherwise, the Geiger counter and the system would be in total superposition. So if the Geiger counter is not in a definite state, then it can't be measuring something in a definite state. So then the whole process doesn't work.
This sounds like some sort of quite generalizable worry about quantum measurements, that there's a possibly infinite regress. Your measurement device itself is really being looked at by some other measurement device, which is being looked at by you, and you're being looked at by your friends. And it's not clear when to stop and say, okay, this really wasn't measurement. That's certainly a worry about quantum theory in general. But I guess presumably that would apply equally to our discussion of the Bloch sphere and to the Geiger counter. If we have a genuine spin half particle and we have some way of instantiation measuring the spin, we still have the same worry about measurement apparatus.
With the Bloch sphere, you're assuming that there is an observer on the Bloch sphere and he's in some sort of definite state. Like you're assuming that because he's able to get definite answers, but
I guess I was assuming that, but if it's
a particle interacting with a particle, it's a quantum particle and a quantum particle, and so there's a chance that particle might not trigger the Geiger counter, even if it actually measures it.
So
the Geiger counter just might not be sensitive because of quantum effects.
Our measurement devices can be imperfect. They can have errors. That's certainly true, and we might need to incorporate that into a discussion as well. I'll take one last comment. I don't want to resolve this problem here. I want to leave it for you to think a little bit more. But I'll take one last comment from the back there.
It's a comment on the last comment. Isn't a situation that it is true that we do not directly measure the particles, but we measure the Geiger counters. But if this argument is true, then shouldn't it also be true that once we do measure all the Geiger counters, then we will find a completely undecayed state with this probability anyway.
That sounds like a fairly standard counter-argument to this sort of worry. But it doesn't, beyond a certain point, it doesn't really matter where you apply what's often called the Heisenberg cut, the point at which you decide a measurement's taken place. So you might want to go through the analysis and actually model the measurement process and see whether that seems to be the case here. But that does sound like a good.
It should be true. Otherwise,
it should be true. Otherwise, we're going to get in.
The quantum mechanics would be inconsistent. I mean,
we're going to get into general problems with measurements of everything everywhere.
Yeah. Can I
leave it at this stage for you to puzzle over a bit?
Is there a resolution to the problem?
I think there's a reasonably clear way of seeing an answer. Yes, but it's also true that it leads into it does also. The problem also suggests there are actually quite a lot of technicalities that you need to get into if you want to think about realistic applications of the quantum Zeno effect. But I think you can cut through them in this particular case and see why the answer is the way it is. Just a moment. Okay. So I promised a couple of quantum Zeno things you could do. One of them is the situation is you've got a state that's moving away from what you want and you're trying to freeze it. There's a sort of converse to that. So let's now suppose that the Hamiltonian is zero, the state's not moving, but you actually want it to move. And you don't have an easy way of applying a Hamiltonian, but you do have a way of applying arbitrary measurements. And the idea, maybe you're even quite demanding. You want it to move not just from here to here, but you want it to follow some particular path. To a reasonable approximation, at least. Okay. So the idea now is that we're going to discretize the path, pick points that are reasonably closely separated in angle pairwise. So psi 0, psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, and so on, psi 4, up to psi n, sitting on the path. And we're going to apply measurements defined by those states and their orthogonal components. So the first measurement, which I guess is going to be a fairly trivial one, is defined by the projection onto psi 0 and the projection onto its orthogonal complement. And then we're going to apply a second measurement, which is slightly different, projection onto psi 1 and its orthogonal complement, and so on. I said these states were closely separated in angle. So the inner product is going to be close to 1. It's going to be of the form cos theta I over 2, where theta I is the angle between these. And all of these thetas are going to be smaller than some small angle theta, smaller than or equal to some small angle theta. What happens here? What happens is that the state was in the state psi 0 before we started. There's no Hamiltonian. So the first measurement actually was pretty redundant. With certainty, we'll still find it there. The second measurement, with probability very close to 1, probability cos squared theta 1 over 2, which is because theta 1 is smaller than or equal to theta. This thing is bigger than this. We'll give the outcome psi 1. Suppose it does. If it doesn't, we failed, and we give up. If it does, we carry on playing this game. So now we carry out the second measurement. What's the probability that we get the outcome psi 2, given that last time we actually got the right outcome psi 1? Well, it's cos squared theta 2 over 2. And again, that's greater than or equal to cos squared theta over 2. And now each time we're interested in the probability of succeeding, given that everything's gone OK so far, given that we've succeeded up to now. And each time, we get an inequality like this. Each of those conditional probabilities is greater than or equal to cos squared theta over 2. So the probability of getting everything right, each measurement giving the right answer all along the path, is greater than or equal to this expression to the power n. Well, that's just that thing to the 2n. And if theta is pi over n, let's say, because the expansion of cos is quadratic around 1, we have inside here something that's constant factor times 1 order 1 over n squared. power 2n for our probability. And we see our probability of succeeding each time, again, tends to 1 as the interval, the separation between these states on the path gets smaller and smaller. We can, so to speak, walk the state with almost certainty along any path we choose just by applying measurements. And it's algebraically trivial, but it's worth sort of sticking in your minds if you haven't played with it before. The key thing here is just that the expansion of cos theta for small theta is order 1 minus theta squared. It's astonishing just how much interesting stuff about quantum theory follows from that algebraically trivial observation. This is one example, but we'll see some others. For instance, the whole discussion of quantum theory against local hidden variables theory and Bell's theorem can be phrased in that way, and perhaps from some perspectives really should be phrased in that way.
Is the Zeno work feasible in experiments?
I'm not an experimentalist, first comment. I kind of assume you must be able to set up some experimental demonstration of it, and maybe polarized light would be the obvious thing to try. I don't know of a reference on that, but we can all look for one. I'll look for one, but you should as well. Do you?
I think in NMR, and I see that because I've heard they record talk about it.
Okay.
But again, I don't know your answer. But polarized light, you could definitely do. If you just put slightly rotated polarizers, in fact, you do this classically.
One question, is taking infinite measurements the same as putting a Hamiltonian for a fixed time? Because when you're measuring, you're putting projections, and a Hamiltonian diagonalizes is also like projection. So it may seem that it's the same, it's actually the same to put a Hamiltonian through a length of time t and make a lot of measures there.
Well, I mean, they're following from different postulates of quantum theory. One's following from a unitary evolution, the other from the non-unitary change that we get when we apply measurements. I don't know what to say about more to say about that really. They seem like physically very different processes as well. I mean, if we're carrying out a measurement, we're really interacting the system in some particular way with some external apparatus or some other system. It was true, applying a Hamiltonian is also causing interactions, but they're not, the dynamics are rather different. It's not the same interaction process. It's also, if you think of applying a fixed Hamiltonian, then there's a clear difference because here we can apply any sequence of projections and so follow any path at all we like, whereas the Hamiltonian will process along some particular path. I would say they're different. Of course, it's true that for any particular step, you could find, if it's small enough, you can find projections that will almost certainly do it, and you could find a Hamiltonian that will have the same effect. So, in that effective sense, if you only care about the end result, the result's the same.
Yeah, but it's like the measure can be, I mean, when you're doing the measure in your physical system, you're applying a Hamiltonian somehow always, right? That's the way you measure, like seeing the eigen values of your, I'm not sure about this statement, but somehow it's like every time you do a measurement, it's like applying a Hamiltonian.
But, I mean, yes, you're right. There's if we sort of analyze the measurement process, there must be some interaction Hamiltonian that's called, creating an interaction between the system and the measuring apparatus. But that's a very different operator from the Hamiltonian that's acting purely on, a Hamiltonian acting purely on the system itself. So, I mean, at some level, maybe what you're pressing towards is, again, this question of whether quantum theory is all about unitary evolution. I mean, if we step back far enough, everything is given by Hamiltonians and unitary evolutions. We're never sure when a measurement actually takes place. But the concrete level of writing down, even if we want to take that view, writing down the actual forms of the Hamiltonians that are relevant here, they're very different. There's a rather nice quotation. This is Yakir Haranov. I couldn't find a picture of his collaborator, I'm afraid. I'm sorry about that. It does give you pause to think about any preconceptions you might have had about measurement, this process. As Aharon of Vardy say, the reason that this thing is walking along the block sphere is because we're carrying out the measurements. And if you think of measurement as just something that's revealing a pre-existing fact about the system, that doesn't seem to make any sense at all. You might say, well, that can only be true if you're certain of the outcome of the measurement. But we're not quite certain, but we're almost certain that this process will work. So it's suggesting to us, and we'll see other reasons, other arguments that reinforce this conclusion, that it's really just a big mistake to think of quantum measurements, even maybe quantum measurements with almost certain outcomes, as just passively revealing some pre-existing fact about nature. It seems to be, if we want to give language to it at all, something more like an active intervention with the system, rather than what classical physics might have suggested, a passive process revealing a pre-existing state. I just wanted to check the time. I'm going to move on. Are there any questions about that? Because I'm going to move on to another topic.
There's another seminar in here at 3. So
okay.
That.
It's quarter to two, which is official.
But we started
a little late, that's true. Okay, I'll press on for a few more minutes just to introduce mixed states and density matrices. Any questions, any more questions about the Zeno effect or not? Okay, new game, new story. Suppose somebody gives you a quantum state and they say, here's your quantum state, you can do whatever experiments you like on it and I want you to make the best predictions you can about those experiments. And you say, fine, okay, what state have you given me? And they say, well, I'm not going to tell you. Maybe I don't even know myself. But anyway, I'm not going to tell you. But what I will tell you is that it's either this one, psi 1, or this one, psi 2. And they go through a list for a while. Or this one, psi n. And I'll tell you more than that. There's a probability distribution. So with probability p1, it's psi 1. p2, it's psi 2. pn, it's psi 1. And that's the complete list. It has to be one of these, so these probabilities have to sum to one. And they're non-negative, or greater than or equal to zero. And that's all you're going to get. You can do what you like in trying to obtain information by carrying out your own experiments, but you're not going to learn anything more about the preparation of psi, about the initial state. How could that happen? Well, maybe some colleague is playing some sort of game with you. I mean, they're rolling dice or tossing coins and deciding which state to prepare. They follow that process reliably, so it's a genuinely random process to the extent we believe dice and coins are random. But they're secretive about the outcome. They're not going to tell you what the actual dice roll was. Maybe you've got a device that's preparing states for you, but it misfires every now and then. It produces the wrong state every now and then. And it doesn't give any evidence of having done that. You can't tell whether or not any given state was a misfire or the correct state. But what you have painstakingly built up through, I don't know, theory, experiment, or whatever, are error statistics. So you know the frequency of the misfires and the types of states that are produced when it misfires. So the question is, what can you do? This is the information you have. Of course, you still have the rules of quantum theory. What can you do with this information? Well, the information is encoded in the box here. And here's one thing you can do, which I guess is the first thing that would come to mind. You've got a list of states and probabilities. You know the rules of quantum theory. So you just need to go through case by case each time and work out what quantum theory would have told you would happen were it this case, and then what would have happened if it was this one, and so on, all the way through. So for instance, if you apply a Hamiltonian, and evolve it for time t, you apply the operator to the minus ht over h bar. Well, if it started out in psi 1, then it will be e to the minus I ht over h bar psi 1, and so on. And so your old list can be replaced by this new list, which actually isn't all, is no more complicated, almost no more complicated than the old list. It's just the same states, but now with the unitary evolution operator in front of each of them, and still the same probabilities. If you make measurements, well, let's, you can do it. The notation maybe get a bit more cumbersome, and this may get a bit longer, but you can do it. So as long as this list is finite, with a sufficient amount of work, you can keep track of what quantum theory says about your state, given the initial information. If it's a short list, maybe that won't even be too much work. But it could be a lot of work. It could mean that you've got to solve the Schrodinger equation n times. It may be difficult to solve it even once. And n may be very large. So that's Hamiltonian evolution. We can also apply measurements, as I said. And if we do that, well, we've got to worry about two things. What is the probability of getting any particular measurement outcome? So we apply a predictive measurement with possible outcomes labeled by J. What's the probability of outcome J? Well, now we've got to go through a little Bayesian argument. It's the sum over all the possible input states of the probability of getting outcome J, given that it was that input state, times the probability of that state. Okay, so this is big P, the projector. That's this expression. This is little p, the probability of the state. It's this sum. And then the other thing we've got to worry about is what happens after outcome J. What's our state now? Well, it's one of the states given by applying pj to these states. So it's one of these normalized states, pj psi 1 up to pj psi n divided by the appropriate normalizations. Which one? We don't know. And even to work out the probabilities, we've got to go through another little Bayesian argument. We've now got to work out, given that we've got outcome j, what's the probability that the input state was I? So what's the probability of input state I given outcome J? It's given by Bayes' theorem. So it's the probability of both of those events, state I and outcome J, divided by the probability of outcome J, which works out to be this ratio. So you notice our list of probabilities has changed. It started out as P1 to Pn. Now we get outcome J. And now we have to rescale all our probabilities and get these actually rather more complicated looking expressions for the new list of probabilities after the measurement. So a little more explicitly, we carry out a measurement, we got outcome J, now we know psi is one of these states, and here's the list of those probabilities. We can do this, but it's looking laborious. So here's the project that we're going to embark on. I'm going to pull something which may be familiar, but if it's not, may look rather like a sort of rabbit out of a hat. I'm going to write down an operator on Hilbert space, call it the density matrix, which is supposed to describe all the information we have about the state when it's first given to us at time zero. So let's call it rho of zero. It's given by the sum of the probabilities, ket of the state times the bra of the state. I'm going to write down an evolution law, which looks relatively simple, although may or may not be familiar, and which at any rate you can easily verify has a simple solution. Rho of t is given by our familiar evolution operator applied to rho times the inverse operator. I'm going to give a prediction postulate, a new prediction postulate for how to deal with these things, which says if we apply a measurement defined by this list of projectors, we will get, sorry, that should say outcome J. We'll get the outcome labeled by J with probability given by, well, there's a symmetric way of writing this, which is PJ rho PJ. But of course, trace is cyclic and PJ is a projection. So that's really, I can just pull this around, and that's really just trace of PJ rho. And if I do get outcome J, then I'm going to change this thing, the density matrix, after the measurement, to something like this, which also has a rather symmetric form, PJ rho PJ over the trace of the same thing. But again, we can compress the denominator slightly. Okay, so the first, if they're unfamiliar, the first three things are sort of rabbits out of the hat. And the crucial bit of the project is the fourth. Check that this is actually all consistent with what we have so far, which is standard quantum theory and the usual measurement postulate, the usual unitary evolution, and the data we were actually given, list of initial states and list of probabilities. So I'm giving what's purporting to be a new, a more compressed term, easier way to do calculations in this situation where we have a probability distribution over states rather than a fixed pure state. And we need to check that this calculus actually gives the right predictions. We're predicting what will happen if you carry out measurements. And we also need to check that it gives all the information we can possibly get, that it isn't, we're not losing information, we're not throwing away something in this process. So I guess we'll talk about that next time I lecture to you, which will be after a couple of guest lectures each by Lucien Hardy and Raphael Sorkin next week. And this is probably a good place to stop here for now. Are there any questions? Okay, good.